We've been talking up here now for a whole month, and it has gone very quickly about pilgrimage. And I have been sort of stealthily avoiding the destination question under the guise of it's about the journey, not about the destination. And I really do believe that. The things I've read about the Santiago in Spain, I've not walked the Santiago, but from what I've read, the pilgrims who walk it are often disappointed when they get to Santiago to the cathedral. It is about the journey, not about the destination. So for those of you who have been along on this particular pilgrimage, you know that one of the most inspiring sentences for me in this whole project was given me by one of the brothers Tizay, Brother John of the Tizay community in rural France. He says that he believes the true destination of a pilgrimage is not the holy site, but home. And you pass through the holy site in order to return home in a new way, return home with new eyes, with new insight, with a new sense of God's presence. So with that in mind, I think we need to talk about destination, because apart from a vision that calls us forward, I'm not sure we're even inclined to move. And before I say any more about that, it's just to say that I'm very aware that in the Bible and in life, there is this tension between place and movement. So there are lots of holy places in the Bible. There is also holy movement. And the same is true for our lives. We talk about being attached to community and serving community, being rooted. Rooted in the gospel, Paul writes, and at the same time, just as soon as we're rooted, we are also uprooted. And so we've talked a lot this month about liminal space, which is the threshold between the old and the new, those places of uncertainty. I'm going to start tonight with a quotation by Gilbert Mylander in his essay called Creatures of Place and Time, Reflections on Moving, because I think it captures this vision. We exist within the tensions of this pilgrim existence. By disturbing the ground of our life, moving seems to rake up all those tensions. I love that sentence. By disturbing the ground of our life, uprooted, transplanted. It discloses human life as it has been created by God. It is a finite and bodily life tied to particular times and places. We are in large measure the conversations we have had, the games we have played, the books we have read, the work we have done. But we are not only that, for we are also on the way. As spirits made to rest in God, made to live in expectations, we transcend every particular location, and we must learn to live within that tension. God ties our hearts to particular times, places, and people. And then the same God tears us away from them so that we may learn to love him with heart, soul, mind, and strength. So there is this tension. God ties us to people and to places and to times, and then disrupts us, pulls us out of that, tears us away from that. That's the liminal space kind of thing. And God does it so that we may learn to see this world with all its beauty in the way C.S. Lewis once described. It is an inn, a resting place, but we should not mistake it for home. God doesn't help to help us learn that a transcendent Christianity is the only kind that gives deep meaning to this life, that we dare not rest the whole weight of the heart's longing in any finite good. And I think the theologians in the room could define the whole weight of the heart's longing in finite good as idolatry, that to keep us trusting, God keeps us moving and thrusts us forward. I like talking about being headed home, because home both connotes place for us, but also qualities. And what would be some of the qualities of home? Let's just say some of the qualities that come to your mind.
Family? And friends.
Mm-hmm. Comfort.
Comfort?
Familiarity.
Refuge.
I'm sorry?
Refuge.
Refuge, yeah. I was thinking safety.
Security.
Mm-hmm. Acceptance.
Mm-hmm. Belonging.
Belonging, exactly. So lots of qualities. I mean, and I think it's important that we talk about it both ways. Because going to say this in another way in just a moment. If we only talk about home as place, I think maybe we're naive or idolatrous. There's a sense in which all of those qualities you describe are dynamic, and they come and go, and we feel them more or less. To imagine that we would get established in them is, well, it's one of the things we're going to talk about one of the possible destinations. When we started this project a month ago, I contrasted the medieval and the Celtic views of pilgrimage. The medieval view is much more tied to place, that we would get to Jerusalem or to one of the cities that is ascribed particular memory of a saint or a particular experience of miracle and so on, and have some kind of spiritual high. The Celtic view is much more about a perpetual wandering so that we would be shaped in the mind and heart of Christ. And I want to keep both of those tensions in mind too. What I plan to do in this session together is that we could think of some biblical places that have been considered holy, talk about some of the qualities, and talk about what they give our pilgrimages in terms of aim or focus. I don't want to suggest that we're going to get to any of these places, at least in terms of quality. But I think each one of them helps us see that there is breadth in the way we talk about the life, and breadth in understanding where we may go. This will make more sense when we just get into it. The four places from the Hebrew Bible that I want to talk about are Eden. I trust you will recognize these places. And Egypt. And Jerusalem. And exile. I think they're all four very powerful pilgrim destinations. When I think about Eden, I think about these senses of defined light.
Yeah, I know.
It's a dark spot right there.
I am a pilgrim.
Looking. When we think about Eden, I think about the ideal. I mean, mostly when we read the Eden story in Genesis 1, it's about a pilgrimage away from Eden. And it's fascinating because for as clear as the text is in that story, that we can't go back to Eden after the fall. I say Genesis 1, it's in Genesis 2, and then in Genesis 3. There are senses in which we keep trying. And particularly if we think of the destination of a pilgrimage as home, I'm very nervous about the idealization of homes, as if it is somehow this utopia, and you know we'll get a home or we'll get home and everything will be okay. I think of that with the holidays coming. Finally, I got to be a campus pastor, so I actually preached this sermon. I was tempted for years in the parish on Christmas Eve to say Christmas is not about family. Christmas is about God coming to embrace the broken. And it's a chance for families to admit that they are broken. And I'm aware that it's a day that many families realize it again. And that almost no families live up to the ideal. So even when I want to say that pilgrimage is about going home, I think it's really important that we think carefully about whether that's real or whether that's romantic. And Eden stands back there in biblical memory as a place that is not accessible to us. Our pilgrimage is away from that. And at the same time, I'll just admit that when we were moving, especially early in ministry, from parish to parish, I was convinced we'd find a better place. This search for an ideal, a better kind of place, I think is a very real part of our experience in pilgrimage, and is one of the ways of thinking critically about destination. Do you really think you're going to find a better place? By the time I served three parishes, By the time I had served three parishes, I realized that every parish has the same characters, they just have different names. And finally, you don't need to move again to get away from them, you just need to make your peace with somehow dealing with them. So one of the things that happens, maybe this just proves that Lutherans are weak on sanctification, I don't know. But it's just to lift up that one of the things that happens in our movements is there is this sense of idealization that we're going to find a better place. Any comments, questions, reactions to Eden as one of the places and one of the set of characteristics that informs our movement? And
I think our culture feeds us that message all the time. There's something better out there.
Mm-hmm.
Be it a thing or a place or a person.
Yeah, or relationship or.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and even so, you know, that possibility is sometimes what keeps you going. You know, like, I know in the midst of the storm, when I'm hemmed in by work on all sides, sometimes it's just that thought of the day with the family. And I know it's going to be tumultuous, disturbing, crashing day, but even that keeps me going sometimes. So there is something to be looking ahead, you know what I mean, in hope of some kind of deliverance.
Well, the word Eden actually means place of delight. Mm-hmm. And certainly delight is... That's a little bit different than the ideal or the utopia or the gift of delight would be another way to think of that movement forward.
You know what occurs to me around that is this, you know, we were talking about kind of good and bad spiritualities, and I don't know, that's not really the best terms, good and bad, but you know, this sometimes that this, you know, if I could just get through my journey on earth so I can get to heaven, you know, it's like an Eden.
Yeah.
And it devalues the journey here. It's like, you know, some spiritualities do that. It's like, just, you know, when I get to heaven, I'll really be close to God, and I just have to get through this earth stuff or, you know, this human stuff. And that's part of that, I think, it's almost like you bypass the learning that comes from the journey, because
when we get through with talking it through in the Hebrew Bible and that biblical story, I want to suggest some ways that there are of viewing Jesus that fit each of these kind of viewpoints and paradigms. Any other comments about Eden? Second place that figures very prominently in the story of the Hebrew Bible is Egypt. And it's a very ironic place. I deliberately put Egypt up there and not Exodus. Because it is a gift of freedom and liberation. And the irony of Egypt is that in the Joseph stories, it was freedom from famine. So that because Joseph had been sold down into Egypt, when the famine came, he helped Egypt be prepared for that, and Joseph's brothers came, and they were liberated then from the famine. The book of Exodus begins with that glib assertion that a Pharaoh arose who did not know Joseph. And now what has been gift in Egypt becomes their oppression. But this is much more we'll just put delight up here for the word. I used ideal or utopia more, but Egypt is the sense of freedom, of liberation, that is very much a part of home, that sense of we will be freed. And it's amazing how the Exodus story continues to inspire people yearning for liberation, becomes paradigmatic and definitive of seeking liberation. The promise that God moves into our brokenness and sets us free. That it seems to me sets pilgrims on a walk toward freedom. To be freed from something or to be freed for something. Even though it is, The story is obviously connected, and it's going to lead to freed for the promised land, which also feeds some of the heaven stuff that you were talking about, Annette. But when we get to Jerusalem, I'm going to think more in terms of fulfillment. The Exodus story is the pilgrim walk. I think the Celtic view fits this very well, to face one's brokenness, one's attachment to things that bind us, and to take steps toward being set free. Nancy's insight for me the first week that we were working on this is how much the way I'm talking about pilgrimage has in common with 12-step groups and the liberation from addictions. And she gave me a great book on it. I've only read a couple of chapters, but it's a concrete example of a step at a time, which is an AA slogan and is about this movement out of bondage and into freedom. Some comments or reactions to the ways we experience that in our own lives. One of the ways I'm thinking about is with service travel or service learning, which the chapel on our campus does a lot of. It's an invitation for us to walk with the bound and the broken and accompany them on a journey to liberation.
I'm just thinking, before we came from Central, sorry, when we were leaving Central African Republic back a few months ago, we had to go through our stuff because we could not bring too much back because it was all going to be air freight. That was the only way to get it back. So you're paying for kilograms there, or pounds. And so we had to make some decisions about what's really important to us, what do we want to hang on to. And I felt that feeling of liberation when we put stuff out to get rid of. You know, for people to come and buy it for a few francs, whatever. But I felt that was liberating.
Are you suggesting that we're bound to our possessions?
No. Take it the way you like.
Garage sales are good.
Yeah. That is a liberation, and it is a bondage. That the word possession just strikes me as so ironic, because we think we possess the things, but there are all the ways that we are possessed. Mm-hmm.
You know, another thing that strikes me from our conversation last night is how so many people have to go through this Exodus experience within the church. I mean, it's like they've been bound up by all the small kinds of thinking that we named last night with, you know, religious thought that can be constrictive and judgmental and guilt-producing and all those wonderful adjectives. You know, it's like it just the internal journey to freedom to step out of that and to set that down and say that doesn't have to define my spirituality, and that doesn't have to the God that I'm seeking is much bigger and much more about freedom.
Yeah.
And I've heard so many stories about that journey in its different forms. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's quite a pilgrimage finding the way.
You see, this is why I think
like the labyrinth.
It's important for us to talk about destinations or aims, even though we may not have illusions about ever getting there. I don't know that we will ever be totally free. Mm-hmm. But as soon as we talk about freedom, we start to name some of our bondages, mm-hmm. to possessions and to restrictive, oppressive thinking or something. I mean, I can attest to this, you know. A friend of mine last spring said, this was a haunting kind of thing. He said he thought sabbatical was better in anticipation than it was in reality. I've been planning this sabbatical for 2 years. Like, the anticipation was wonderful. it's so easy to fantasize that you're going to get out from work and you're going to have this year that will be open and free and spacious. And then, of course, what ends up happening is you confront all the internal stuff, all the drive that keeps making you busy and thinks you ought to be productive. And that doesn't go away just because schedules go away. So there get to be layers of bondage. And if you know a 12-stepper, an active 12-stepper, you know they talk about this as a lifelong process, a day at a time.
I think it's interesting, too, you mentioned the 12-step because in Christmas, as well, because a lot of time I think the drinking and the medicating of yourself really increases around that time. I think to deal with that very fact that it's not the utopia you thought it was going to be, that there are tons of griefs and feelings to go through, conflicts and family and all that stuff.
We swap one bondage for another.
Yeah, exactly.
All
yeah.
the time. Yeah. For sure. Well, you see what I'm doing here. I'm just very loosely. I mean for this to be evocative, not exhaustive. There's no way you can do all of the theology of all these places all the way through. I mean, in between here, another place that I do think, well, maybe we should just put it up as a possible destination, is wilderness, is the wandering. Certainly, there's a sense in that those of us who go to the Boundary Waters or go wilderness hiking do go to the wilderness as a destination or as a metaphor for our seeking. I put up Jerusalem as a, this isn't F, as a place of fulfillment. That at long last, some 1,000 years after Abraham and Sarah, the promise to them that they would have a land and a place is fulfilled, and they get the place. Now, the interesting thing is that I don't think there's any question, but what Jerusalem becomes a very holy and significant place for the covenant people. But the development of that place in the Hebrew Bible is very rocky and uneven. They start with a nomadic God. The presence of God in the wilderness is carried between an ark. And so the building of a temple is challenged and questioned and all around. David wants to build the temple and the prophet says no. Solomon builds the temple, but there's a huge question about how desirable that would be. Israel insists, before Saul, Israel insists on getting a king, and there are all these questions about that. And the interesting thing that I think happens in terms of arrivals is once you get the fulfillment, then there gets to be this effort to kind of secure it. And for so much of the rest of the Hebrew Bible, then, we've got the prophetic challenge to this place. So I thought somewhere in here we should sing Jerusalem, my happy home. But the hymn is naive compared to the drama and the tension that that surrounds this. And I tell you that because if, as pilgrims, we are seeking fulfillment on some level, vocational fulfillment, or sense of self, or receipt of the gift, or awareness of the gift, and however we may describe that, it's important to know that even in the holiest city in the book, it's a huge struggle to know if arrival, landing there, locating that is a good idea. But Jerusalem remains pilgrimage site. And fulfillment wouldn't be the only reason. There are lots of rhythms and rituals, remembrances, all of them. But that may be a good way to get at fulfillment, too. I think we do envision our pilgrimages, our journeys, as movements toward fulfillment. Any comments or questions about that one? Peter, I loved your line last night when you said, did you say I'm empty because I'm so full? Which is the marvelous gift of the exile. In 587 BC, Nebuchadnezzar defeated Jerusalem. The temple was destroyed. and the people were carted off into exile in Babylon. When I graduated from seminary, I was convinced that Nebuchadnezzar was one of the most important characters in the whole Bible. And so I was trying to think of how to get my confirmants to remember the name Nebuchadnezzar. Susan and I were newlyweds at the time. And I told him that if we ever had a son, we would name him Nebuchadnezzar. Which is, it helped their faith in a funny kind of way. It is, they think, why we got three girls. I think the importance of the exile for people of faith, and particularly for the Bible, cannot be overstated. That just at the moment that all was lost was the time that the people were stirred to write the story. So vast portions of the Hebrew Bible were written in the midst of this exile time as the people sought to reclaim and re-identify and reappropriate all that they are. I mean, Ian set us up for this beautifully because this is really the liminal space understanding. You're headed for emptiness, for letting go of it, and then for a transformation, which is to say that it will be renewed. Last night when we were having the, what word do I want to use? Caricatures of the Bible in our discussion. I just felt like there was a lot of caricature about how much warp and weft that the people who believe the Bible have got it all figured out. I just wanted to scream exile because everything that was promised was then lost. And in the midst of that loss was rediscovered. And out of that loss then was written down and recorded so that the creation account is in sharp contrast to the creation accounts of Marduk, for example. And the memory of the Exodus is reappropriated in a hope that we will have a new journey back to a new Jerusalem. The destruction of the Davidic covenant, the covenant to David that said a descendant would always reign on Jerusalem, is renewed here in the hopes of a new descendant of David. And so this is really the journey to newness. And it is by way of the loss of all that had been given. Are there comments and questions about exile as a pilgrimage destination?
I'm thinking that happens probably to most of us during our life when some major calamity occurs in our life.
It does.
Losing a spouse or a father or mother or someone very dear or whatever, or losing a job,
yeah,
maybe, or you're sort of losing your identity in a sense, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
What's made you who you are at that time, and you go through that period of roaming. I mean, you missed out in between Egypt and Jerusalem, but you know, there's some of that in that period of exile too.
There's way more wandering.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. And to say that all of those losses are legitimately loss and or at least change of faith.
Mm-hmm.
They affect our faith.
For sure.
To let go of. So, in light of that, I think this helps us think about Jesus as a new Adam, Jesus as a new deliverer, Jesus as the new heir of David, descendant of David, to sit on the throne of David. And Jesus as new life, by way, of course, of the cross. There get to be various kinds of ways of talking about this. I think for example, Jesus announces the reign of God, and sometimes that is described as a messianic age. The blind receive their sight, the poor have good news preached to them, the dead are raised, and so on. It's more political. It's also at times understood as the body of Christ, which is more organic. But this sense of Jesus opening for us these movements, which are different kinds of movements, toward a different sense of arrival. I mean, liberation is not exactly the same thing as fulfillment. Neither of them is the same as losing it all for the sake of gaining it anew. How do you think various points of view affect the walk we take, the step at a time, thinking about being headed to various places?
What struck me about exile is that that is kind of the disillusionment of finding what you thought was the home site or the end site is disappears or is destroyed or you're pushed out. And it reminds me somewhat of those stages of life where you look so eagerly. I have a good friend who's just longed to be in certain positions in the rock and roll world through his life. And each time he gets there, he's just totally crushed because he has to keep moving on. You know what I mean? He's just crushed because it's like, I got here. Oh my God, I've got nothing else to. Oh, I guess I have to look toward that now. You know, and that's kind of a different journey than this, maybe a little bit. But it reminds me of that disillusionment.
Or maybe not. I mean, in some ways, instead of putting this in a row, this might be better in a circle.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
You know, I don't think it's linear, but I don't know that it's even cyclical. I just think it comes and goes. There are certain things that they have in common. These two have quite a bit in common in terms of facing brokenness. I think in terms of one of the things that it helps me to think about in terms of various biblical visions for hope, all of these could be hopeful, is to be really wary about fulfillment. Or when we receive it, to receive it as gift, and then be ready to let it go.
Yeah.
Farmers understand that this year's crop needs to be next year's seed, and next year's risk.
And that also speaks to the abundance of God's gift, too. If you continue to move on, and you just don't get it, and you got it.
Yeah. And it certainly speaks to not arriving, and to not embracing that.
You know, I was thinking about the Eden as, you know, we were sort of speaking a little bit about its shadow side of, you know, the terms of perfection, and we can't go back to perfection, and but the light side of Eden is, you know, it's kind of the vision of the reign of God that fuels our visioning and hoping and working.
Yeah.
You know, the place of harmony.
Shalom.
Yeah, the place of shalom that, you know, it's the destination that calls us, that beckons us, that we know, you know, it isn't here yet, but the invitation is to take the step and the step and the step to help create that shalom. You know, that I love the, you know, when Barbara Rossing wrote her book on Revelation, she talked about the, you know, the paradise regained and the vision in Revelation about its harmony again. And the new creation image that calls us and feeds us on the journey.
I appreciate you talking about that in terms of light side and dark side, because every one of these has a light side and a dark side. Liberation is also transient. You know, the danger of liberation theology is that the when the oppressed get liberated, they become new oppressors. You know, Dan Erlander, who teaches up here so much, when he talks about the book of Exodus, says it takes so much longer to get Egypt out of the Israelites than the Israelites out of Egypt. Egypt is in them, and so liberation is also fleeting. And if you try to protect it or hold it or
I was just thinking of the whole matter of human sexuality in the ELCA right now.
Mm-hmm.
And partly because of today Bishop Wells sends a monthly newsletter out, and he just returned from the bishops' annual meeting, all the bishops, ELCA bishops. And he asked the question early on in the article, where are we now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in, was it 2007, the church called on everyone to walk together faithfully.
Right.
And so you have some people who perhaps are experiencing a certain sense of fulfillment, you know, at this decision, even while other members of the communion are, what, feeling like they're in Egypt or...
Mm-hmm.
That's where I think body of Christ language is so helpful. The body is broken and yet called to move together.
I think it was Ralph Klein that said, if the church is in exile, it's a time for the church to come to its senses.
Mm.
You know, reevaluate, renew, how can we be different?
Yeah.
Or what, you know, what newness are we called to?
To come to its senses. We've talked all the way through about the power of movement to heighten our senses, to make us more aware of what's around us. And exile, no doubt, does that.
You know, the other thought about exile that came to me is that sometimes we, you know, when you said it was an exile that they really were kind of forced to claim who they were and to define their story.
Yeah.
And it makes me just think about that sometimes when we're removed from our known, comfortable surroundings that we were really forced to ask, who am I? It's you know, what is my story? What are my foundational myths? And there's a little bit of that, you know, the church having to ask itself that in this sort of exile of disagreement and tensions, you know, to say, well, who are we? And what is our fundamental myths? And are they going to be as inclusive as they could be, or are they...
And there's a sense in which every one of us is needing to ask that.
Yeah. Yeah, both in
terms of our call to love one another, we're all asked to re-examine that.
Yeah.
The last question I wanted to talk about as destination was heaven. And what do we make of heaven? There are a couple of ways of hearing that in the scripture. When the scripture says eternal, I don't so much hear it talking about life after death as I hear it talking about the things that endure through death, the things that are loving and true and just, persist, and are not disrupted by death. So that sense of eternal has the sense of starting here and now and continuing. But certainly in popular Christianity, there is a lot of hope for, if not focus on, life after death and the meaning of heaven there.
Mm-hmm.
You spoke sort of to the dark side of that, you know, when you brought it up, because it can be earth-denying.
Mm-hmm.
If we just get to the new Eden in heaven. I think that the more positive constructive, the light side of it, I would claim, is the freedom it gives us to give our lives away and not worry about that. We are free to die, and we will be loved creatures in God, even though we die, so that we're liberated from securing ourselves, holding on to ourselves. It isn't all we've got. we belong to God and that transcends death. Which I think has a lot of power for propelling pilgrims forward. And certainly is part of the Christian witness when you read people like Martin Luther King who were so aware that they may be sacrificing their lives, but knew that the call of God for the people of God needed for them to do what they were doing. How does that function as promise or challenge for you as pilgrims in the earthly journeys?
I really like the way you just described it as God with us, the eternity now that holds us even after our passing, even after that. And I think I've also gotten a little more, or tried to be a little bit more understanding and tolerant of that Pearly Gates notion, especially living in the South, where that's a lot of people, you know, the, and I don't want to mention denominations, but you know, there's a big emphasis on that as the time of reward or whatever for that finally arriving. But I think as metaphor, and maybe that's one way their language experiences the eternal, and I think part of my job is to allow that while in dialogue about the eternal right now. I think the scary dark part of that is that when you're in a canoe heading to the cruise ship, it's very easy to misuse the canoe. So, you know, your life present, to throw away opportunities with caring for the earth, caring for others, justice issues, and that will all be erased.
Well, in Barbara Rossing's book, the one Annette was referring to, I mean, she talks about the really dark side, which believes the earth should be destroyed.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that heaven can come. Which I don't see as biblical at all. I think one of the most succinct ways I found to sort of dialogue with that thinking is to remind folks that Jesus taught us to pray on earth as in heaven, not in heaven as on earth. That the goal of his ministry, for which we're praying every time we pray the prayer he taught us, is not to get out of earth for heaven, but to get heaven into earth.
Yeah.
And but similar to what you're saying about Eden and the place of delight, I think that hopefulness that ultimately life will prevail and justice and peace is a powerful factor in our willingness to move, to take a step, to take a risk, to live forward.
Say that again.
Well, what did I say? That the sense that life will prevail, the hope for peace, ultimate peace, is a powerful force in getting us to move, to take a step. And I think especially for people of privilege. People who are oppressed have way less to lose by moving. And so, but when you've got something to lose, you've had a bunch of fulfillment, then that is risky, and it's important to hear both the call to something greater and the ways in which that comes to us in minuscule sorts of ways, every day, incarnate ways. Are there other destinations or ways to think of destination that people would want to bring to the discussion?
Well, I just think it's important to have some kind of piece of coming home to yourself. You know, that journey to coming home here to your true self, and you know, the journey of the all the experiences we have and learnings we have that help us shed our false selves and unveil more and more the child of God within that God created me to be. I mean, that's kind of a lifelong pilgrimage of continuing to reveal that more and more. And it comes through all these turns in the journey of the losses, the successes, the, you know, the unexpected. unexpected times of exile, and they're all opportunities to come back.
Do you have a way to articulate that that also includes relationship and connectedness to others?
Well, just that the truest personal self is the one in communion.
Right.
You know, with, and not just with humans, but with all of creation. That it's, well, we said that, you know, our home is the earth. It's not just us. It's not just,
yeah,
it's not just our race. It's just not our kind. It's all creation.
I think I back off talking about that authentic self. I certainly agree that that is a sense of home, because we're so individualized, and we tend to see that so much a part of our autonomy, that authenticity. And I just think I'm most authentic with others, that it's impossible to understand myself as a father apart from daughters, or as a friend apart from, you know, or a member of the body of Christ apart from the authenticity of other members. So these, you know, I just,
you want to
keep
the relational, keep
that
intention.
I do, yeah. And keep that about God's authenticity for the whole creation. It has the whole creation yearning for rebirth and reconnection.
I can see some of that point, though, when someone is compromised, or I want to just say depressed, or let's say they're really at odds with their identity in the world, and sometimes that comfort of knowing that core is complete, now go, you know, to have that impetus. And again, I think that partly comes down to all our personalities and how we deal with others and how much we like our alone time. But certainly, without that community, you're right, we don't really have our identity. We're made to be together.
Yeah. Well, and Carl Jung articulates that in terms of the lifespan, too, that in early adulthood, we carve our identity more externally,
mm-hmm,
in relation to externals. And the second half of life is more about the internal authenticity, living more out of inner strength. I'm not a psychologist, but I've been reading some of that, and I'm fascinated by it. In case I could be approaching the second half of it. We'll see.
Not even close.
Any other comments?
You said that a minute ago about authenticity. One thing that I can articulate as well. But one thing that I've always had an inkling about in my own life is that when I have, quote, lost it, whatever it might be,
mm-hmm,
it is my relationships, my friendships, those members who keep the authentic Tom safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like it's passed to them while I have my operatic moment or whatever. And then at some appropriate time, they give it back to me.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You know, and without that, I don't know where else you have to store yourself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like I don't want to go too far with this, but I mean, you know, just put my real self in the alibi for a while and then
you're starting to sound like a Dan Brown novel.
You know, Tom, it's the sequel to The Lost Pupil, it's The Lost Tom.
Yeah, there you go.
Tom, I just want to say that I still think it's important to name that even if the web isn't around you, that God is still there. So, because we ultimately rest in God's arms, not in our...
See, I want to say the web is still there, too.
But I'm thinking of people who really are in situations where they are alone.
Okay.
I mean, they don't maybe have a loving friend, or they don't, they're cut off, and they're there's not a human presence that's incarnating God, that I guess I just feel like we need to ultimately be held by God and not completely rely on. So it's the both hand, it's not either or.
It is a both. And it's fraught in that, because as soon as we talk about authentic self, then we have to talk about how our most authentic self is to be given away as self and relinquished, so as to be renewed and alive. I just have a sense that articulating this will require pilgrimage. What do you think? Thank you so much for your participation in the discussion.